is not necessary.
Dámy a pánové, jsme krátce před startem našeho dnešního fóra a teď jsem přemýšlel, jestli mám mluvit česky anebo anglicky, ale budu asi mluvit česky, protože většina sálu mluví česky, je to tak. Kdo mluví česky? To je většina, to je většina. Tak dovolte, abych vám popřál dobré ráno a ještě jednou to zopakoval, přeju vám dobré ráno, protože to je ta poslední dobrá zpráva, kterou dnes během přednášky uslyšíte. Náš dnešní host, který přijal pozvání na Fórum hospodářských novin, je vám všem určitě dobře známý, pro někoho je to kontroverzní, pro někoho možná příliš pesimistický, ale v každém případě velmi úspěšný investor. Naším dnešním hostem je muž, který když byl poprvé v Praze, tak ten den přijeli ruské tanky. Já doufám, že se to dnes nebude opakovat. Naším dnešním hostem je Mark Faber. Dobrý den.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Peter, for inviting me, and thank you very much for the kind introduction, and thank you all for giving me the opportunity to share some of my views with you today. Actually, I'm very happy to be in Prague, because the first time I came here was in 1968, and I had just completed my exams in Switzerland at the university, and I drove my VW car at that time to Prague, and it happened to be August 20th. So I parked near the broadcasting building, and during the night of the 20th, I saw planes flying over. So I asked the people, because I was in a nightclub at that time, what is happening? So they said, well, the Russians are coming. So as it happened, the Russians immediately occupied the broadcast building, and my car was surrounded by Russian tanks, which made moving around quite difficult. But it was a very memorable experience for me, because it shows by how much the world has changed over the last 30, 40 years. I mean, I moved to Hong Kong in 1973. At that time, Mao Zedong was still alive. We were just ending the Cultural Revolution, which had been very painful. And we were still in the midst of the Vietnam War. And the whole of Asia at that time was still, like Czechoslovakia in 68, was still extremely poor. And in just 40 years, we have had countries in Asia like Taiwan and South Korea that have become prosperous, and China, which began to open up in 1978 under the open door policy of Deng Xiaoping, has not everywhere, but in some areas become quite prosperous, and certainly, as we shall see, a huge economy. So if I look at the last 30, 40 years of the changes that have occurred also in terms of technology, we didn't even have mobile phone in the 70s when I started to work on Wall Street, and we didn't have fax machines. And so, A, the changes in the economic geography of the world, in the balance of power in the world, and also in terms of technologies are just been huge. And I think that in the next 30 years, the changes will once again surprise us in many different ways. Now, as you know, the world was in boom conditions until about 2 years ago, and then we went into a very serious recession, a financial crisis, and there are many different voices at the present time how to come out of this crisis. One of them is Mr. Paul Krugman. He won a Nobel Prize in economics, and he thinks that the best for the world would be to have another bubble. The problem is that he already thought that to be the case in 2001, and we know now what the consequences of the bubble after 2001 were, namely the credit bubble, the housing bubble that led to the present crisis. In fact, I would argue that the Fed, in other words, the central bank's policy in the United States, has been largely responsible for higher economic and also financial volatility, which I'd like to summarize as follows. As you may remember, at the end of the 1990s, we had in the world a capital spending boom that was built around the TMT sector, technology, media, telecommunication. The Nasdaq in America, which is a broad-based stock index of technology, media, and telecommunication stocks, high-tech essentially, went up by 48% between 1997 and March 2000, and between August 99 and March 2000, the Nasdaq doubled, but Mr. Greenspan couldn't see a bubble at that time. But after the bubble burst in March 2000 and Nasdaq went down strongly, the Federal Reserve became concerned that we might have a deflationary recession, and so they slashed interest rates here from 6.5% on January 3rd, 2001, to 1.75% by year-end, and then down to 1% here in 2003, and then they left the Fed fund rate at 1% until June 2004. I have to explain that the economic recovery in America began actually in November 2001. So almost 3 years into an economic expansion, you still had a Fed fund rate of 1%. And then the Fed increased in baby steps the Fed fund rate here to 5.25%. But as I shall demonstrate in a minute, we never really had monetary tightening occurring. And then they left the Fed fund rate here at 5.25%. And when the Federal Reserve finally noticed that we had a subprime problem in the United States that was concentrated in the subprime sector, but in September 2007, the Federal Reserve finally noticed that it wasn't an isolated event, the subprime problem, but that the whole US financial system was subprime. So at that time, the economy was weakening substantially, and they slashed again the Fed fund rate now to zero. But this has led this monetary policy of the US, artificially low interest rates here in the period 2002 to 2006, essentially, has led to this huge credit bubble we had, the asset bubble we had, to overspending in the United States, so in other words, to high economic volatility. And this other collapse here in the Fed fund rate has led to what I would call essentially a huge speculative wave at the end of 2007 in commodities. You can see this is the CRB index. This is the broad-based index of commodities. It includes oil and metals and also agricultural commodities. Depending on the weight, it moves in different directions. But in any event, the CRB had peaked out in 1980. In other words, up here somewhere, it had peaked and had been in a bear market until here, 1998, when it bottomed out at 182, made a second low at 185 here. And then, as I shall explain, driven by the incremental demand for commodities from China, it went up strongly and peaked here at 365 in May 2006. After May 2006, we moved sidewards, in other words, in commodity prices. But when the rate cuts occurred here in September 2007, in other words, here, these rate cuts, the CRB went ballistic and peaked out here at 473 a little more than a year ago in July 2008. When you think of it, the recession officially in the US began in November 2007, and global demand was weakening already in the second half of 2007. So this whole increase here in the CRB was purely driven by this artificially low interest rates here, because people went and speculated on commodities in expectations of higher inflation. The same occurred for oil. The oil price here had bottomed out at $10 in 1998. By year 2000, we had already reached $30. Then we went here and peaked out around $80 in May 2006. Then we traded around the $75 here. But when the rate cuts came, we went from $75 here up to $147 last summer. Now, I'm not entirely subscribing to this theory, but the interest rate cuts here that occurred pushed up oil prices, and as oil prices went up, it of course hurt the consumer. And some economists argue that the rise here in oil prices after the rate cuts actually pushed the consumer into an even more cautious mood than he had been before. Then after the summer of 2008, we totally collapsed here to $32 at the end of December 2008, and since then we're up back to around the $80 level. So you can see the Fed's policies, the monetary policies of the United States, have led to A, very high economic volatility, and B, huge financial volatility. Another side effect of US monetary policy is the excessive debt growth. Here you have credit as a percent of the economy, US debt as a percent of GDP. You can see that here in the 1920s, in the period preceding the Depression years, credit was growing at a very fast pace. And then during the 30s, 1929 to 33, credit as a percent of the economy went up strongly because GDP collapsed by 25%. But afterwards, in the 30s and 40s, there was a period of so-called deleveraging here. And noteworthy is also here, when the US went into the Second World War, debt to GDP was just 140%. In 29, when just ahead of the Depression, debt to GDP was 186%. Now, after the 1940s, we had essentially debt to GDP moving along in a flat line. In other words, the economy was growing at about the same pace than total credit. But here, after 1980, when debt was still at 140% of GDP, we went up, and we're now at 375% of GDP. But 375% of GDP does not include future liabilities in America arising from Social Security, from Medicare and Medicaid, which are estimated at between $58 and $110 trillion. Nobody knows the exact figures. But if you added those here to the total credit as a percent of the economy, we would be at 700%. And that becomes burdensome, as I shall explain in a second, for other reasons. But I'd like to make an observation, and the reason I'm talking about this debt explosion is really that about a month ago, Mr. Krugman, who I referred to before, wrote an article in the New York Times. It was 6,000 words. In other words, a very detailed article. And the title of the article was, "How did economists get it so wrong?" The title should have been actually, "How did I, Paul Krugman, get it so wrong?" But the point is, the whole article doesn't mention in a single sentence that excessive credit growth, excessive leverage, led to economic and monetary instability and was responsible for the crisis. The economists explain it in America for a variety of reasons, but the economists at the Federal Reserve, at the Treasury, and also at universities like Harvard and so forth, they will never tell you that excessive credit growth led to the crisis. But when you think of it, between 2000 and 2007, the US economy expanded by $4.2 trillion and total credit expanded by $21.3 trillion. In other words, to generate $1 of additional economic growth, credit was growing by $5. The other reason I'm talking about this is the following. The last time the US pursued tight monetary policies was here in 1979-1980 under Mr. Paul Volcker, when he pushed up the discount rate to over 20%. At that time, debt to GDP was 140%. At this level of debt to GDP, 375%, in my opinion, the monetary policies in the US will never again be tight. In other words, they're going to print and print money. There's no other way out. And that will have consequences obviously on the value of the US dollar, on the value of paper money in general, and also, of course, on the value of asset markets. Now, I have to explain something about the philosophy behind US monetary policy. The US Federal Reserve, under Mr. Greenspan and Mr. Bernanke, have argued that they can't identify bubbles. But Mr. Greenspan, a year ago, he wrote an article in the Herald Tribune whereby he said that Spain had a housing bubble. So in Spain, he could see it, but not in the United States. But the point really in America is that the Federal Reserve pays attention to so-called core inflation. Core inflation is an inflation measure of, it's like a basket of consumer goods and consumer services that are weighted in different ways, and therefore the results can be very different. And it excludes food and energy. So it's an incomplete measure of inflation. But as far as I'm concerned in this room, everybody still needs to eat food and uses energy. So that is excluded in the Federal Reserve's target for inflation, core inflation. Then the Fed argues we can't identify bubbles, but if a bubble occurs, we know what to do. We can liquefy the system, and as Mr. Bernanke explained and wrote, we can drop dollar bills from helicopters onto the United States and create inflation and support asset markets. So basically, each time there was a crisis in the US, 1990, the SNL crisis, the Mexican tequila crisis, LTCM, each time they liquefied the system, there was a crisis, they just threw money at the system, and credit as a percent of the economy, as I've shown before, was growing and growing. In fact, the bailout of LTCM here in 1998 was, in my opinion, a huge mistake, because it gave a green signal to the financial sector, notably to Wall Street, you can keep on leveraging up. There is a Greenspan put. In other words, if something goes wrong, we will throw money at the system and bail you out. And when Mr. Bernanke became Fed chairman, people argued there is a Bernanke put, but with a higher striking price. So this is the philosophy of the Fed, and it was helped to some extent, and I have to explain this very in details, this was helped by essentially continuously declining interest rates in the 1980s and 1990s. Now, interest rates and commodity prices, they move in very long cycles. We call them Kondratiev. They last 45 to 60 years. And they move essentially in sync. In other words, rising commodity prices are accompanied by rising interest rates. When commodity prices go down, interest rates tend to go down as well. So the last time we had a bottom in commodities and in interest rates was here in the 1940s, when the 10-year U.S. Treasury was less than 2%. Then the 10-year Treasury was still here at 2% in 1949. It went to 4% in 1960, to 6% in 1970, and then we peaked out here on the 30-year bonds at 15.84% in 1981, on September 21st, precisely. Thereafter, the yield on the Treasury securities went down and down and down. And in my opinion, and this is debated by the deflationists, but in my opinion, we made a major low in interest rates on December 18th, 2008, in other words, a year ago, when the 10 years touched 2.08% and the 30 years touched 2.53%. After December 2008, we still had extended weakness in the economy between January and March 2009, but interest rates were already rising somewhat. And this is important because the deflationists will tell you that the Treasury bonds in the US are the most attractive investment, that the yields will go down on the 10 years to less than 2%, to 1.5%, and on the 30 years to less than 2.5%. We were at 2.53% here. But I shall try to explain why this is unlikely and also why, in my opinion, after a 27 years bull market in bonds here, 1981 to 2008, that it is likely that over time interest rates will go up in the United States. And that will have a huge impact on the interest payments on the US government debt. You have to see that the US government debt, the average maturity is 4 years. In other words, when interest rates on the short end go up, the interest payments on the debt will go up, and this will in time become very burdensome for the United States. Now, the other thing that is important to understand in the philosophy of the Federal Reserve here is that I can understand that someone can argue, well, it's difficult to identify bubbles, and in some cases it may be difficult to identify them. But the credit bubble is relatively easy to identify because it's a period that is characterized by credit growing at a faster pace than the economy. Now, even in this room, if we had a gold standard, in other words, we have a limited quantity of money, we can still get bubbles. Say, if someone made a major invention over here, or if someone discovered an oil deposit over there, or a gold mine, then it's logical that in this room, the businessman will be attracted to take advantage of the profit opportunity here. So money will flow from the back of this room into this corner of the room, and here you will get a price level that will go up. Stocks will go up, real estate will go up. But because money is constant in this room, as the money flows out of the back of this room, in the back of this room we'll have deflation. So any bubble you look at in the last 200 years, whether it was the railway booms in America in the 19th century, or the canal booms in America, or real estate booms, was always accompanied. Somewhere there was a bubble, and somewhere there was deflation. It's like I just explained here in the case of the United States. 1970 to 1980, commodity prices went up. Gold went from $35 to $850, and oil from $3 to $50. But bond prices collapsed. Or in 1989... we had a bubble in Japan, but we didn't have a bubble in commodity prices or in the Western world. So usually, in 2000, we had a NASDAQ bubble, a technology bubble, but steel stocks were depressed, oil stocks were depressed, all the old economy companies were depressed. So it was in one sector of the economy. But what Mr. Bernanke and Mr. Greenspan managed to achieve is to create a bubble everywhere. Here is an index of various bubbles, 2002 to 2008. Everything goes up. Stocks, in other words, equities, all over the world, in developed markets and in emerging economies. Real estate went up all over the world. Commodity prices went up. Bond prices went up. And, of course, art prices went up and worthless collectibles and so forth. There was only one asset class that went down, and that was the US dollar. 2002 to 2008, everything goes up, the US dollar is down. Then comes 2008, everything collapses, but the US dollar is up. And then you get to the turning points at the end of 2008, as I said, December 18th, the bond market peaks out, in other words, interest rates bottom out. Then end of February 2009, you have the dollar, which was strong here, 2008, to end of February 2009, the dollar starts to weaken. And March 6, 2009, the stock markets in the world, led by the S&P at 666 for the S&P, bottom out and start to go up. It's very important to understand this relationship. Strong asset markets, weak US dollar. Strong US dollar, weak asset markets. And then since March 2009, again, strong asset markets, weak US dollar. The relationship exists because when the dollar is weak, it is a symptom of liquidity flowing into the world, excess liquidity being created, and that is of course good for asset markets. Whereas when the dollar is strong, it is a symptom that global liquidity is tightening, and this is bad for asset markets, and is bad also for essentially certain businesses, not all businesses. But this relationship is important. It's also important to remember that this asset bubble here was, I mean, very pronounced. In other words, everything went up in value, and the wealth destruction here was also extremely pronounced. You can see stocks lost from the peak in 2007, in October 2008, 2007 to the low in 2009. They lost $32 trillion globally. And what is also unusual, and this you have to see, that this is the main difference between this crisis and previous crises, is the housing market in the United States. In America's post-Second World War, home prices never went down nationwide. They went down in the early 80s in Texas, and they went down in the early 1990s in California. But nationwide, they never really went down. You can see 73-74 recession. It was a very serious recession in the world, but home prices continued to go up. 82 recession, serious recession, but home prices didn't go down. Here, 90s recession, not so serious recession, but they went down a little bit because of California. The rest of the country didn't go down. But this time around, we had a very significant decline in home prices. Now, the Federal Reserve and the Treasury will tell you this is the problem for the U.S. economy, that home prices went down. To this, I would say, keep in mind, in 1997, Hong Kong property prices peaked out, and then they dropped by 70%. None of the Hong Kong property developers went bankrupt, and very few households had financial problems. Why? Because there was no leverage in the system. The property developers in Hong Kong are largely family-owned. They use very little debts to finance their business. A lot of properties in Asia are 100% owned. They have no mortgage debts. But in the case of the U.S., the problem was this here, homeowners' equity. Homeowners' equity is how much money a household has in his house. In the 1950s, it was 80%. In other words, somebody bought the house for $100,000, then he would borrow $20,000, and $80,000 was his equity. So homeowners' equity was 80%. In the 73-74 recession, it was still 70%. Here also in 81-82, now it's 43%. One in four homes in the United States is underwater. In other words, the mortgage is higher than the value of the house. That is the problem, excessive leverage. It's not that home prices went down. It was the creation of credit that was allowed by the U.S. Federal Reserve and actually encouraged. Earlier, I mentioned that there was never any monetary tightening occurring in the U.S. This is credit growth in the U.S. in percentages. You can see here in the June 2004 quarter, when they started to push up interest rates from 1% to 1.25% and so forth, total credit in America was growing at an annual rate of 7%. Then they pushed up interest rates to 5.25%. But what happened with credit? Credit growth accelerated here from 7% in 2004 to a peak of 18% at the end of 2006. But you have to ask yourself, what was the Federal Reserve smoking in the United States? That they couldn't see that this excessive credit growth would lead to some problems down the road. And then the private sector began to act rationally and cut credit growth, but then the rate cuts came September 2007, so it accelerated once again. Then in 2008, private credit totally collapsed because of tighter lending standards by the banks and also the households' unwillingness to borrow more money because the household had enough debt, they wanted to repay debt, so that actually the household sector acted rationally. Now, if you have an economy that, as I shown, is credit addictive, in other words, they depend on credit to grow, and you suddenly have this deceleration of credit, and it's now negative here, private credit grows, then you have a major economic problem. The Federal Reserve, they know that. So what is happening now in the world is the private sector is acting rationally. They cut down credit, in other words, they repay debts, they don't want to take on new debts. But the government comes in and takes over the debts. So what you have is the private sector is retrenching, the government is throwing money at the system and is building up huge fiscal deficits. Between January 1st of this year and the end of the year, the total debt of the US government, debt of the US government, will increase by $2 trillion. In other words, the essentially creditworthiness of the US government is going down, and that's why I don't think that government bonds are particularly desirable. And also, I would like to add, if you look at fiscal and monetary policies, through fiscal policies, you can stabilize the economy. Let's say you have a deficit of $1 trillion. Then you go to a fiscal deficit of $2 trillion. It has a moderately, I have to say, a moderately stimulative impact on the economy. But once you are at $2 trillion and you go down again to $1.5 trillion, that leads to a contraction in economic activity. So I believe that actually the government in the US will come out with a second stimulus package in 2010. And as a result of that, the government debt will go up. Now, the problem will occur when one day in future, the government debt is very large. At the present time, short-term interest rates are, as you know, are zero. The government can issue treasury bills at zero interest. But sometimes in the future, the Federal Reserve will need to increase interest rates. What will then happen is that the interest burden on the government debt will, of course, increase very substantially. And that will make it very difficult for the fiscal deficits in America to come down altogether. Now, I have essentially spoken negatively about the asset markets. The Federal Reserve's policy is, of course, to deflate this cash bubble here. In other words, in America, we have very large deposits in money market funds, in the banking system, and by keeping interest rates at zero, the US government essentially wants to force people to do something with the money, to either go and spend it or invest it into asset markets to essentially keep push up the asset markets. And to some extent, they've succeeded. In other words, since March, stocks are up and the real estate market is about to kind of stabilize at the lower level. But the side effect, of course, has also been that commodity prices have gone up and that the dollar has been weak and so forth. So there are always side effects. But basically, the policy, and I think this policy will stay in place for a long time, is to keep short-term interest rates at essentially 0%. And when they will increase interest rates, to keep them below the rate of inflation, so to force people into asset markets. Now, the impact of US monetary policies in America were largely negative. We created a credit bubble and then a housing bubble. The housing bubble allowed people to refinance. In other words, home prices went up. So people could go to the banks and on the same house take out larger loans. And so what they did is they went and took these larger loans and they went and spent it. And this led to the US overconsumption, which was reflected in the growth in the trade deficit here. 1998, the trade deficit explodes. This is the overconsumption until 2007. And recently, as the consumer retrenched and as his savings rate went up, the trade deficit has been shrinking. But we are interested in this period here, 2000 to 2008. This period was characterized also by the increase in the current account deficit in the US from annually $150 billion to over $800 billion. So suddenly, the US overconsumes, and the trade deficit leads, of course, to a trade surplus somewhere else. Somebody has to produce for the United States. The current account deficit flushes the world with liquidity as it goes from $150 billion to $800 billion annually. $800 billion flows into the world. That, of course, led to the excess liquidity. On the other hand, the trade deficit, the overconsumption in the US, led, to make it simple, to the Chinese having to supply the goods for the US consumption. So in China, industrial production goes up, exports go up. As industrial production goes up, incomes go up. In other words, more people are employed, their wages go up. As a result of that, they earn more money and they go and spend it in China. And as exports keep on rising, as a result of this growing trade deficit here in the United States, the entrepreneurs in China commit the so-called error of optimism. In other words, they think that exports will keep on going up, so they build more and more factories. So you have the impact, essentially, of China consuming more domestically because of better employment opportunities, of industrial production going up, and capital spending going up. And because China is resource poor, it drives the demand for resources to the right and results in higher prices. And this not just for oil, but in the case of oil, you see what happened. The combined expenditure of oil in the world were $500 billion here in 1998. At the peak of oil prices last year, they were $4 trillion. So in other words, this was a huge change in the world for not only the oil producers, but the producers of iron ore and copper and other industrial commodities and also of food products. Because as I explained, commodities had peaked out here in 1980. 1980 to 1998, 2001, commodity prices go down. So what the resource producers of the world produce, the Africans, the Middle East, Central Asia, Russia, Latin America, Australasia, what they produce is going down in price, namely commodities, and what they're buying is still going up in price. We call this worsening terms of trade. But after 2001, what they're selling is going up in price, and what they're buying is not going up a lot in price. So suddenly the resource producers of the world became immensely rich, and they could go on a buying binge and buy consumer goods and capital goods in Europe and in Japan. And this resulted in the first global synchronized boom in the history of capitalism. In your lifetime, it is unlikely that you will see again a synchronized boom. This never existed because under colonialism, you never had synchronized growth in the world. And as you know, when colonialism broke down with and after the Second World War, 40% of the world's population was under communism and socialism and policies of isolation in India. So at that time, you didn't have a synchronized boom here either. So every country, whenever you traveled around the world 2 years ago, wherever you went, there was a construction boom, there was a stock market boom, employment went up, exports went up, and economic activity was booming. And this synchronized boom has now given to a synchronized bust. By the way, there was only one country in recession here in the last few years. It was Zimbabwe, because it's run by Robert Mugabe, the economic mentor of Mr. Bernanke, a money printer as well. So this is important to understand, and this was facilitated. I have to say, I'm very critical of US monetary policy, but it was facilitated by the US overconsumption, which led to the export boom in China and other Asian countries, and their rising demand for commodities, and the rise in price in commodities, well, that could lead to this synchronized boom. But obviously, it's not sustainable in the long run. Now, the other feature that is unusual, and this is something that we have to be aware of, we live in a very interesting time from a global macroeconomic point of view. Because until recently, and by the way, even today, if you go to Western Europe and the US, People still live in dreamland. They think we, the Western countries, are the rich countries. We know how to innovate. And the stupid people in the poor developing countries, they know how to work in factories. And that they're poor and that they're economically insignificant. But the fact is, for the first time ever, in emerging economies, car sales now exceed car sales in the developed world. Also, oil consumption in emerging economies exceeds oil consumption in the developed world. So today, it is true that the GDP per capita of Vietnam is only $800, and in India it's maybe $900, and in China maybe $2,500. And so on a per capita basis, the emerging world is relatively poor compared to per capita incomes in Western Europe and the United States. But because 80% of the world's population lives in the poor countries, in aggregate, their demand is very high. And so they are no longer economically insignificant. In fact, they have become economically very significant in addition to that. As a result of this U.S. trade deficit going up, the current account deficit went up. And so it led to the accumulation of foreign exchange reserves in the world from $1 trillion here in 96 to now over $7 trillion at the present time. Most of it is in the hands of emerging economies and of Japan. Now, this is significant because some people say, oh, in Asia, we may have another Asian crisis. Yeah, we will for sure have other Asian crises. But not for the reason that the Asian crisis happened in 97, which was a crisis that was preceded by growing trade and current account deficits in Asia. When the foreigners refused to finance them, everything collapsed. This time around, it's the poor world, the emerging economies that have the foreign exchange reserves, they go and lend it to the United States in the form of purchases of treasury securities. I should add that the big reserves here are, of course, very substantial in the context of the quantity of gold that Asian central banks hold. In China, the central bank holds less than 2% of its reserves in gold. And as you know, the Indian have started to buy gold. And so the demand for gold from Asian central banks could be very substantial as the Asians try to diversify out of US dollar holdings. But this shows how the emerging world has financially become essentially relatively well-to-do and affluent. The other feature I hinted at before, the share of G7 countries, of essentially the rich countries of the West and of Japan, of world's GDP is going down, and the share of emerging economies is going up because emerging economies are growing at a much faster pace than the United States. Now, I have to accelerate a little bit here, but what I really wanted to show is some of the economic factors that will drive Asia in future. One of the features of Asia is that we have a very low level of urbanization. As you know, in Western Europe, the US, most countries have an urbanization rate of 95%. In the case of China, we were at 29% here in 96. We're now at 44%. In other words, the 20 million Chinese, they move every year from the countryside to the cities. So it leads to the construction of new cities, the expansion of existing cities, and that necessitates, obviously, the building of buildings, the whole infrastructure that goes with it, transportation, and so forth, and so on. And that is, to some extent, a driver of economic growth. I'm not saying that this is necessarily going to push up stock prices, but I'm just saying that this is an important pillar in economic growth in Asia. In India, urbanization is only 30%. You have 1 billion Indians, and 700 million, they live in the countryside. Over time, they'll also come to the cities, so that will also lead to economic growth, and of course, high infrastructure expenditures in India. The other point is, the Asian countries, especially China, relative to their population, are resource poor. China has tungsten, but it has very little copper. practically no iron ore, and compared to the population, little oil. So that the demand for resources from China will not vanish. Also, you have to see, I mentioned before that we live in times that are unprecedented in the sense that we had the synchronized boom and the huge changes occurring. This has never happened before, that a country could gain so much market share on world markets in such a short period of time. Here you have the share of China in steel production. They went from a share of 10% in 1990 of world steel production to now 44% in 20 years. In the case of aluminum, we went from 10% in year 2000 to now 33%. In just 10 years, you get 33% of market share compared to 10% 10 years ago. This is incredible. And this will, of course, continue to drive the demand for raw materials in the world. I'd also add that a lot of people say that China will collapse. For sure, a country that is growing at the pace of China and of its size will have from time to time serious economic setbacks. That is no question about this. And I also don't believe the statistics in China that suggest that the country is growing at 8% per annum at the present time. The Chinese, they learned one thing from the Americans, is how to massage and fake economic statistics. But the point is, in China, the debt level is relatively low. We have a total credit market debt of just 100% compared to the world champions, the UK, at over 500%. But in the US, if you added these liabilities I was referring to from Medicare and Medicaid, we would also be at 700%. So at least you can say in China, the system is not over-leveraged. Or you take Vietnam. Only 8% of people in Vietnam have a bank account. There's no mortgage market. People pay cash for their houses. So we don't have in Asia over-leveraged societies, and we don't have social security obligations that will come due in the next few years as a result of aging. Also in terms of per capita consumption, in China, oil is just 1.8 barrels per annum. In India, 0.8 barrels. Here in South Korea and Japan, it's 17 barrels. In the US, around 25. The US has 308 million people. They consume as much as Asia with 3.6 billion people, namely 22 million barrels a day. So in my opinion, it's one thing is sure. The oil demand, when you have industrialization, the oil demand goes up strongly. Like here in South Korea, 1965, 1990, Japan, 1950, 1970. Here in China, the oil demand will go up. And also here in India, you can see the trend is up. So also in emerging economies, you have still a rising oil demand, whereas in the developed countries, the oil demand is basically going down. So I think that in general, I would argue in future for higher, not lower oil prices. In general, oil prices and also other commodity prices will go up because also consider the following. 1980 to 1998, oil prices go down, commodity prices go down. Nobody went and looked for new mines. There was no supply response. In other words, capital spending went down. When the additional demand from China came in, prices went up. And so I believe that the trend will be for higher commodity prices. And I'm alluding to that because obviously in the world, we also have to look at other factors than what the Federal Reserve is doing. And one of the factors is obviously you have the rich countries of the West, including the US. The US considers itself the superpower. And then you have the emerging world that is coming up. The superpower is, of course, not particularly happy of now rivals coming up. And I can assure you that the economic power of China is very substantial. Brazilian exports to China today are as large as Brazilian exports to the United States. They have a huge influence geopolitically. And the other point that is important to understand, in the 70s, in the last oil crisis, when oil went up strongly from $2.50 to $10, And then finally to $50, the US was still over 70% oil self-sufficient. That was only 25% of oil in America was imported. But now 73% of US oil is imported. And in the case of China, you can see that the oil reserves are going down, the production is flat, and after 1994, they became net importers. You know, the Chinese need oil for industrialization, the US needs oil for consumption. And so the US is not here in Iraq because of human rights. The Chinese are not here in Sudan because of the landscape. It's about oil. And this is, for China, a top priority are resources. That you have to see. Because don't forget, the US has one huge advantage. The US has the access to two oceans, the Pacific Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean. And they can source oil from Canada, Mexico, Venezuela, west coast of Africa, the Middle East, and the North Sea. But the Asians, they source 95% of the oil here from the Middle East, and it comes on the shipping lanes through the Strait of Malacca, here between Malaysia and Sumatra, then up the Vietnamese coast, up the Chinese coast, past the southern tip of Taiwan, into Japan, Korea, and the northern ports of China. The Chinese, they have access to an ocean, here the Pacific Ocean. But the problem is American bases are all around here, in the Philippines, in Taiwan, in Japan. So the Chinese access to the sea is very limited. The access to oil is very limited. Now, the Chinese became very concerned because of the American presence here in Central Asia. So you have to see, the Chinese, they built a pipeline to Kazakhstan and they want through Central Asia have access to essentially Iranian gas and oil. And so the presence of American bases here is of course not very desirable from a strategic point of view because the Chinese are obviously encircled here and encircled now here. The Russians are also not very happy about the American presence here because they're encircled in Western Europe and here also now. So the tensions have been rising. The Russians and the Chinese formed the Shanghai Cooperation Organization that includes essentially the Central Asian republics of Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan, and the observing members are Mongolia, India, Pakistan, and Iran. If these observing members would join, they would have 45% of the world's population. But basically what I'm driving at is that the tensions are rising, that the interests of the Chinese are totally opposed essentially to the interests of the US. The US would like to essentially have permanent bases here in Central Asia, but that is not the wish of the Chinese. And so I think that in future, international tensions will actually also have an impact on asset markets. And when war breaks out, you want to own physical commodities, not derivatives, with a bank. Because during war times, commodity prices go up strongly here, Napoleonic Wars, American Civil War, World War I, Vietnam. I think that may happen in the next war again as well. Now I have to rush a little bit and conclude the presentation with following observations. The last 10 years, equity returns in the Western world were dismal. This is the compound annual return for US stocks over the last 10 years. It's very seldom that it's negative. When it's negative, it's usually followed by a better performance in the subsequent 10 years. So I would argue it's quite likely, for other reasons I'm going to explain in a second, that the US stock market and other markets made major lows in March 2009, that those lows will not be exceeded, largely also because of monetary policies. So I think that is important to understand. The lows could occur inflation adjusted. That could occur new lows. In other words, that inflation exceeds the appreciation of stocks, as I shall show. But in nominal terms, I think we've seen major lows. Secondly, What in my opinion can happen in this, likely to happen in the United States, is the following. The financial crisis we had in America has similarities with the petrodollar crisis of 1980-81 in Latin America. At that time, when the oil price no longer went up, the OPEC surpluses didn't flow anymore to Latin America, and there was a credit contraction in Latin America. So what the Latin American countries and Mexico did is they printed money and they piled up huge fiscal deficits, you know, it was budget deficits of the government. And what the result was then high inflation. So if you look at the performance of equities during that time, the following transpires. This is the Mexican stock market in local currency, in peso, 1979 to 1988. We start from a low of 1,000. We went to a peak in 87 of 343,000. In other words, up 343 times. And then we had the crash in 87, but we still close at 139,000 in 88. In other words, in stocks, you were up in local currency by 139 times. Now, because the currency collapsed, this is the Mexican peso, the currency collapsed. In dollar terms, the performance was very different. This is the index in dollar terms. In other words, you adjust the peso index for the exchange rate. In dollar terms, we were here at 48. Then, because of the sharp collapse in the currency, we went down to 5 in dollar terms here in 83. But after that, stocks, because they went up here strongly, and the depreciation of the currency slowed down. In dollar terms, stocks went from 5 to 220. So a huge gain in even in dollar terms. But then they collapsed again and they finished at 62. So whereas in local currency you went up from 1,000 up 139 times, in dollar terms you were just up 25%. But the point I'd like to make is, even if you exchange dollars for this weak currency that depreciated by 98%, you were still in stocks better than in cash and in bonds. In local currency cash, you were killed. You lost 98% of your money. And in bonds, even more. In stocks, you were protected. You started at 48 in dollar terms and you finished at 62 in dollar terms. So at least you didn't lose any money. You didn't make much, but you didn't lose. So my argument is, in the US, they can print money like crazy. The Dow Jones can go to 100,000, can go to 1 million, can go to 10 trillion, anything. It depends on how much money you print. It will not go up a lot in real terms. But what is real terms? Is the euro much better? Maybe not. But I would say real terms is probably gold. And as you know, here, in 1999, one Dow Jones Industrial bought at that time 44 ounces of gold. Gold at that time was $250 and the Dow Jones was close to 13,000. They bought 44 ounces of gold. Now it buys less than 10 ounces of gold. And I suppose that we can go to a period where the Dow Jones only buy 1 ounce of gold. Possible. But we don't know how much money they will print in the US. My impression is that they will print and print and print, and that the dollar will, of course, over time lose essentially all its value. In Asia, also, I'd like to point out, we had markets like Japan, they were at a 30-year low in March 2009. Taiwan and South Korea were 20-year lows. If the US were at the 20-year low, the S&P would be at 300 and not 1100. So we had major lows in Asia. I'd like to also mention, I have some themes here, real estate, not in financial centers, countryside, farmland. Commodities still volatile, but I think you can't print commodities the way you can print paper money. Financial services in emerging economies, notably in Asia. And then infrastructure, tourism will be a huge thing in Asia because over time, the largest group of tourists over time in Western Europe and here will be Chinese. Long, essentially gold and silver, short US government bonds. Corporate bonds still moderately attractive, that there are new regions in the world that are opening up. My main concern is that the crisis, usually a crisis leads to some major changes, but in this particular case, nothing has been changed. The problems have not been addressed. The cracks in the wall have been painted with white paint, but not repaired. And that we will have eventually another crisis, because basically the private sector is contracting credit, but the government is increasing credit, and so total credit as a percent of the economy is still growing. So we have an over-leveraged US economy, and whether the next crisis begins in next year or in 5 years or in 10 years, I think it will be very severe. But before you have that problem, what the government will do, in my opinion, is inflate and print and print and print, and then you get high inflation rates. And amidst high inflation rates, the standard of living of the population goes down, but the standard of living of the Goldman Sachs partners goes up. In other words, Wall Street does well, and the typical household doesn't do well. And then, in order to distract the attention of the people, you go to war. That is usually the end result. And then the whole system breaks down. Thank you for your attention.
Děkuju moc. Já jsem vás varoval, že to tak bude. Skončili jsme válkou. Já myslím, že teď máme čas na otázky z publika. Já se možná zeptám, Marka, existuje ještě nějaký jiný ekonom, investor, který vidí svět tak černě jako vy? Get a translation or not?
No, I didn't get the translation, but it doesn't matter. But if you have any questions, you're welcome to ask, and you can then translate the questions.
That's fine. I was just asking, is there in the world any investor or economist who sees the world in such blackish colors as you?
Well, I think I'm relatively optimistic. I said, you know... I said stocks can go up for a while, because if you print money, everything goes up. As I've demonstrated here with the Mexican market, you know, we can have another move up here for the Dow Jones. And if you print money, you can postpone the problem. So maybe you have another so-called, in economics, you would call it a crack-up boom. You know, there's an artificial boom driven by credit. And obviously, afterwards, the whole thing collapses. But that can be 5 years from now. And between now and 5 years, lots of things can happen. So, and I think in my presentation, I pointed out the reason or the areas where I'm relatively optimistic is emerging economies. I think the difference between Western society is that in Western society, most markets are saturated. In other words, everybody has a refrigerator, everybody has a washing machine, and everybody in America has two or three cars. So the markets don't expand. But in China, 80% of people who buy a new car, they never had a car before. They're first-time buyers. Don't ask me how the traffic is, but basically, they all drive for the first time. So the markets can expand. Or in India, you have a situation where Tata Motors is now making a car for $2,500. So before, a car cost $10,000. When a car costs $10,000, among the billion Indians, you may have had, say, 5 million Indian families that can afford to buy a car. But at $2,300, now you have maybe 50 million families that can buy a car. And this is also why I am totally opposed against the philosophy of the US Federal Reserve that argues deflation is bad and inflation is good. In many countries, goods deflation is good because the affordability improves. In other words, when a car costs $10,000 and then another car only $2,500, then many more people can buy the cheaper car. And so the markets are expanding, and We have also in Asia, we don't have social security. We don't have health care like in the United States. So people, they have to save, they have to rely on themselves. And when there is a crisis, they tighten their belts. In Singapore, the ex-prime minister will go to the Singapore people and say, now times are very bad, you have to tighten your belts, endure for 2 or 3 years economic hardship, then after you have a recovery. But in America, they can't tell that to people. The people would all commit suicide if they knew how bad it is. Yes, they would need the Prozac sales would go up.
So do you see any chance for a European country or for country in our shape and in our economic situation to take advantage of the potential growth of the economies you just described?
Well, I think that countries, A, in the Middle East, in Africa, and I would also argue in Turkey, and of course also here in Eastern Europe, and in Asia, they have to become much more Chinese and Asian conscious than, say, leaning too much to the United States, because the big customer will be the 3.6 billion Asians in time. And, you know, the world is a huge place, and the Asians will do certain things. Samsung is the largest manufacturer of electronics, consumer electronics in the world, and then the Asians, they need engineering, and so they have engineering contracts with Western firms, and also the resource producers, they need Western engineering and so forth, and specialized products. So for a country like the Czech Republic or Switzerland, there's some opportunities. But obviously, the worker that assembles a car in Western Europe, and this is in the steel industry and so forth, he's not going to do very well. Because there, the competition is just too tough.
But what would you advise to a country which is exports to China is slower than export to Saxony, not to Germany, just to Saxony?
Well, if they're lower, then the country should make an effort to increase its exports to Asia, because that's where the growth will be in future. At the present time, I can see that in Western Europe, you know, the trade relationships between Germany, France, and Switzerland, Czech Republic, and so forth, they're, of course, very substantial, because, say, the French, they will go and buy Mercedes cars, and the Germans will buy Citroën cars. So there's an exchange of goods that is quite natural. But if you really want to create value in your exports, then I think that you have to look at Asia from or far more than is being done at the present time. And also in terms of investments, let's say multinational firms, they will have to go where the growth is, and where there is an absence of over-regulated markets. One of the problems of the US is over-regulation. Makes it very difficult to build businesses in America because of regulation and healthcare legislation and legislation about anything.
So, far questions from?
Yes, please. Yes.
Microphone is coming.
Okay. I can shout, so this is fine. So, Radovan Bershat, IBM. I wanted to ask you, how do you see? Is it on here? How do you see the future of euro, and probably in at least two respects? First, in the respect of the ramification and heterogeneity of the European market and different intentions or different strains in the financial policies. And second, as the counterpart of the future on the rough sea, which you have pointed out, euro versus dollar.
Well, the first part of the question, I mean, I'm not wildly optimistic about Western Europe, and it doesn't mean that Western Europe and the US, by the way, will sink to the bottom of the ocean. But what I want to really emphasize is that, and I have a daughter, she lives in Western Europe, I don't think her standards of living will be better than mine. I think her standards of living in future will be lower than what I had, because when I finished universities, there was very little competition. And now you have 20 million Chinese students coming out of universities every year. And the Indians the same. And you have to see one thing. In India and in China, to get into a good university is incredibly difficult because of competition. And so the people there, they don't go skiing for the weekend and sailing and partying. They work as a student 7 days a week and so forth. And so they achieve a very high level of knowledge. And again, that kind of knowledge, people in Western Europe will have to fight. And you, since you work for IBM, you know very well that today the large IT manufacturers in the world, they all have huge expansion plans in Asia because they want to take advantage of this know-how that the Asians have, and of course also of the lower costs of having people in Asia develop R&D, and also that is also applies to the healthcare sector, the pharmaceutical companies. They all shift their laboratories to China and India because they can carry out research at much lower cost. So I can't be overly optimistic about Europe, but Europe has one huge advantage. It has very beautiful cities, so it can become an open-air museum, and every hotel will have a Chinese restaurant and cater to the Chinese. And before, in the 50 years ago, you saw movies where the little Chinese were carrying the coolies were carrying the luggage of the rich people from the West, and in future, the Western people will carry the luggage of the Chinese and of other Asians. I mean, the wealth creation, you have to see when you have a current account deficit in the US of $800 billion. So a huge shift of wealth going to emerging economies. And that's why we suddenly have so many well-to-do people in emerging economies. And how much wealth has been created in Europe in the last 10 years or in the United States? What has happened in Europe and the United States is wealth has shifted from Peter to Paul. In other words, from the working population essentially to the financial sector. That has occurred. But real new wealth creation has not been very significant. Of course, there have been some internet entrepreneurs that I concede, but that is a tiny portion of the population.
Euro, the currency.
The euro. I have bad hearing, not your pronunciation. No, the euro, in my opinion, is a more desirable currency than the US dollar. But again, it's paper money. And the problem for the euro is this. If the Federal Reserve in America keeps interest rates at zero, and they have further quantitative easing, and it seems that this will be the case, and the ECB is in a position, as other central banks around the world, where they should increase interest rates. But the euro has already been very strong against the US dollar. And then the ability to increase interest rates is not very good. Because if they increase interest rates, the currency becomes too strong. That is the problem. So I think actually that US monetary policy, and that the Chinese are aware of that, and the Asians, they fuel again bubbles because essentially nobody wants to increase interest rates when the US has zero interest rates because of fear of the currency becoming too strong. And I can tell you personally, since I travel a lot, I think the price level in Euroland and in the UK is actually now quite high at this exchange rate compared to the United States. The US, you know, if you go to outside New York City, to other cities in America, the price level, in my opinion, is about 30% lower than in Euro, in the Eurozone, and also 30%. If you take a taxi in New York compared to a taxi in Switzerland, taxi in Switzerland is probably three times more expensive. Of course, the food quality is also better in Europe, that for sure. I mean, the food is horrible in America, by and large.
So as we are running fast out of the time and becoming hungry, we have time for last question.
Steve Booth, PricewaterhouseCoopers. I am one of those Americans who's lived through all those bad times. But I'm very...
Don't worry, you're a nice one.
I'm a nice one. I'm very interested in your comments about the financial system and the cracks being painted over. That, I absolutely agree with you, for the U.S. is true. What do you feel about the European banking institutions? Have they fixed their problems? And what can we expect in Europe?
Well, I think, again, I don't think that really the problems have been fixed, and that there are still plenty of assets on the bank balance sheets that will cause further losses. But I think that the response in Europe has been somewhat better than in the United States, and that in Europe the banks are, like in Japan and in Asia, repairing the balance sheet in the sense that they're issuing additional shares and enlarging the capital base. But I mean, the Americans have a very high debt to GDP ratio, and in Europe we have less that problem, but we have another problem that is worse, and that is the demographic trends in Europe. This is, I mean, worse in terms of the aging of the population and the ratio of the working population compared to the retirees. That is in Europe worse. So the future liabilities are also very substantial. So again, I mean, I'm not here really to judge which bank is worse off, American banks or Western European banks. All I can tell you from a stock market performance point of view, if you are a bank and you get money free of charge from the government, and I really don't overestimate the intelligence of bankers, but you would have to be dumb not to make a profit. You get the money free of charge and you can lend at high interest rates. It's a recipe to essentially re-liquefy the balance sheet of the banks and to essentially give them profits. And so from a stock market point of view, the financial sector may actually perform quite well. In other words, that banks could, you know, Citigroup was a $60 stock. It went down to $1. It's now at $4. Can easily go to $10 because before it goes again to zero. So all I'm saying is essentially financial stocks, including insurance companies, brokers, banks, given the fact that they get money free of charge from the government, should be able to make a profit. And over time, rebuild the balance sheet. What will not go away for some time is now we had the housing crisis, in other words, the mortgage loans that went sour, but the next shoe to drop is really commercial real estate. That still huge losses coming worldwide.
So unless there is no a really short question, there is not. So I would like to thank you, Mark, for
my
your
pleasure.
That was really very interesting, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
And I would like to thank all of you for coming and for listening. And please read Hospodářské noviny. We will try to keep to print it all the time in Czech and not to switch to Chinese yet. So, yeah, and everyone has a small refreshment there.